Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professional. I am Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Allen Greer, 2013 president of the IEEE CS, a world-ranked top international technology authority. David, I know you're extremely busy with a very tight schedule, and especially with demands made by both on your professional side as a career, but also on this nonprofit side as the incoming president for the IEEE CS. So very much appreciate and thank you for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Well, thank you. I'm very pleased to be here and very grateful to be able to make room to talk with you.
Now, David, you're internationally renowned. You have this remarkable career of success spanning, you know, many, many, many years in many domains. Because of that, can you detail your prior roles and then some valuable shareable lessons that you've learned from each role that the audience will find valuable?
Well, sure. The lessons that I think I've learned out of this is the trick, the challenges of managing people coming up with new technological ideas and getting them into a bigger audience and to a bigger institution. And that process has to be handled with care, and you have to be very patient with it. In the IEEE Computer Society, I have been very active in the publications role. I started as a writer for the IEEE Annals, and I rose through the ranks of that. I became an associate editor, where I handled some columns, and then I became the associate editor-in-chief, where I handled a lot of the dealings with the IEEE. And then I became editor-in-chief. And then after I did that, I shifted into being a writer for the flagship publication, Computer, and was very active in helping shape that and identify new topics and new ideas for it. And as that, I started rising up through the managerial ranks. I became the vice president of publications for the IEEE Computer Society. And then ultimately last year, I was voted in to be president. And in working with the people who are researching and who are writing and who are trying to apply ideas and figure out what the best practice is, I've learned that, one, you need to trust them. In particular, you need to trust them when it looks like, to your best sense, that they are going badly astray. And you need to be patient with them. But at the same time, you also, at times, a little bit of a feedback, just a comment that says, this is a different point of view, might it be useful, can often bring focus to a problem, focus to an article, focus to an implementation that someone is working on, and help them see it in a new light and all of a sudden start to find a better solution for it. So those have been the roles I've had in the Computer Society. Outside of that, I've had a variety of roles. I've been a programmer and implementer for the Old Burroughs Computer Corporation. I worked with customers for that corporation for a great deal of time. I've been a university professor and a university administrator. And I think in all of these roles, the challenge that I have faced time and again are, how do you work with technical people who are trying to solve technical problems and often have to deal with people who don't understand the deep issues of the problem and can't really articulate what's going on, whether that person is someone trying to describe an administrative procedure that they need a system to support, or they're running a large complicated computer system that they have some grasp of what's going on inside but need something else being done, or a group of highly trained, highly educated, highly experienced technical people who are doing something that they think they know well and are in the process of discovering something new about it. You know, in all of these, there's a need of patience, a need of communication. My mother used to say that when you're dealing with children, you have to follow the rule of three yeses. If you're not clear of what they're doing, you start asking questions until you get three yeses in a row. I think that rule is maybe a little simplistic, but sometimes you do have to go back and start going until you affirm that we're all understanding the same thing and the same issues. You ask questions until you get positive replies and you're saying, ah, we're now connecting. We now understand the issue a little bit better. So that's what I've been doing.
Now, we have this organization, the IEEE CS. If you could just briefly outline who they are, then after you do that, you know, what are going to be your top challenges in your role as 2013 IEEE CS president?
Well, you need to sort of do this in two stages. The IEEE is the Institute for Electrical and Electronic Engineers. It's the biggest professional organization for people involved in electrical and electronic equipment in the world, and is made up of a variety of people, from PhD researchers to technicians who work on this equipment and develop it. It was founded in 1883. Edison and Steinmetz and others were part of its founding. And in the mid-50s, it developed a subunit called the Computer Society, which dealt primarily with computer problems. And it first dealt with the hardware problems. How do you make switching elements and other memory and other pieces of computers? But as the 60s and 70s moved forward, it really became the central focus for people interested in software engineering, for people dealing with programming and systems and how you organize them in a systematic and organized way that can be developed, can be improved, can be refined, can be fixed. In this, we've got, the IEEE has 400,000 members. The Computer Society is close to 100,000. And the challenge is helping them have an environment in which they can really practice their field and learn more about their field after they have left school, when they're now on their own and having to behave as professionals. And so, you know, the first challenge is identifying the information that they need and getting it to them. And one of our biggest tools is a thing that's called SWEBOC. It's an acronym. And this organization is nothing if not an organization of acronyms. It stands for the Software Engineering Body of Knowledge. And what this is it's almost like a giant encyclopedia, but that doesn't quite capture it. It's a large document that basically says, these are all the major topics of software engineering. This is what you need to know to be a top-line software engineering professional. This is how you think about a system. This is how you design it, how you get specifications, how you construct it, how you test it, how you debug it. And this body of knowledge is something our volunteers maintain. And then once you have it, you have to figure out ways of breaking it up. And as my grandmothers want to say, getting the hay down where the goats can get it, getting it in a form that is useful for top-line engineers, for midline engineers, for people with responsibility of maintaining systems, for people who are just working on very humble tasks. How do you give them information that helps them? And we've been doing a lot of thinking about that, including different formats, different ways of breaking it up, different pedagogical approaches, and different ways of organizing the SWEBOC itself. We're going through a major revision that's going to be done. It was originally going to be the 2006 revision, and it's looking pretty clear we are going to get it done by 2012. So that's one of the first, I think, real key things. But education for technical professionals also involves other things, and one of them is the ethical side of it. And when we think ethics, we think of good and bad and people doing things that are wrong. And it's actually a much broader set of skills and ideas. It's how do you work as a professional? How do you treat your client? How do you treat others in the profession? How do you think about them? How do you communicate and what you need to communicate? And these are skills that you really don't get from a book or from a webinar. It's really something that you get by working and dealing with others, by dealing with others in the profession. And I have been going around and seeing our local chapters and our local organizations and seeing how people learn from each other in these ways, how they get ideas from someone in a different field, a different job or a different company, and find and apply it to their own field. Now, in this day and age with, you know, the internet and social media, some of these local organizations that are based on, you know, an earlier model of communications are struggling a little bit. But the need is still there. The need of learning from your peers, of having friends, or of even just having colleagues that you don't consider friends, but you learn from them, is important. And we have been doing a lot of very systematic thinking of how do we get that kind of experience to people in the social media age. It's not just slapping up a Facebook page or starting a Twitter account. It's doing things to get meaningful interaction between our members. And then finally, I think there's always a challenge of presenting this field to the public, that it's very easy to stereotype them, to view them as people who love technology and are not all that fond of people, and who have communications challenges or other challenges in dealing with the world. Can I, as the president, present this field in a way that helps the outside world understand it and also provides a model for our members to advance it? Because, you know, they're the core of it. You can't really stand up and say, I define the organization this way, but you can be a voice for it. And being a voice means you have to listen to them. It means you have to talk to them. I come from, as I like to say, a chatty family, and I enjoy nothing more than sitting down with people and saying, tell me about your job. Tell me about what you do. What's your last accomplishment? What was the biggest challenge you had? And extracting from people those stories allow me to tell the story of the society, not only in the public way, you know, the pronouncements and the promotion, but also when you're dealing with policy issues, when you're dealing with governments and businesses that have to have a long-term set of rules and ideas for governing their relation with computers. computer engineers and software engineers and security engineers. And that's a challenge, but it's one that I just find incredibly exciting, because these are people who have over 125 years substantially changed the way the world works and interacts and organizes itself. You know, in most parts of the world, we've forgotten what it's like to end your day when the sun goes down. We have forgotten what it's like to be out of touch when you're beyond a day's walking distance from your parents or children or friends. We have forgotten what it's like to have to organize our personal finances and our interaction with our companies with paper and pencil and needing to know the arithmetic to do it. And these tools have forced us into a new role. And I think it's important for someone to stand up and say, these are the people that have done it. These are the challenges they face. These are the accomplishments that they have made. And this is what they have brought to the world.
David, you're in a unique global position in that you see much. You're the incoming president of this very, very large and prestigious organization. And also you have this long history of success in many, many domains. Now, because of that, and from that perspective, what do you see as the top challenges facing the ICT industry?
Well, I'll try to get five, but I think I can get close, certainly. The first, and without question, the biggest one, right people in the right place, solving the right job. The human challenge is, without question, the biggest, because it involves people and families and where they live and how they organize their daily lives. And those things aren't always easily transferable. Also, because the industry has been so fluid, that the demands, that the ideas, that the applications have changed so rapidly, that we see people left behind very, very quickly. When they're trained for one kind of platform, one kind of problem, all of a sudden the world changes and they're not prepared. I have a report that was done for the U.S. government. Actually, it was the American National Academies of Science for the U.S. government on high technology for the next decade, that's written in 2007. And it's a very good group of people that wrote it, people I respect immensely who've done good research in the past. And they have a section in that report on the future of the PC industry. And they lay out several ideas about where it's going. They see it flattening a little bit, but it's still going to be the dominant platform for computing for the next decade. And, of course, that's coming right on the cusp of tablets and smartphones. And it's not that these aren't smart people and missed it. Certainly, they saw it coming. But at that point, there's just not enough information and detail for them to realize the tremendous impact that smartphones and smart tablets have had on the computing industry. And in terms of personnel for that industry, it has meant that people who were trained in what was, by 2007, the conventional personal computer, all of a sudden had to scramble, not only for new sets of skills, but also for a new way of doing things. And that was a big disruption in the programming industry. So I see that as clearly the first challenge facing the ICT industry. The second is is related to it, and that's bringing new ideas to market. The model that we have right now, which seems to be working but is quite anxious in how it approaches, is that most of the new ideas come through small startups. You get someone who is often an undergraduate or a master's student, grasps an idea from their schooling and takes it out and starts to transform it into a business. Because of the way we now do technical education, we're often sending people out with great technical ideas who don't have the business skills, or conversely, people who are prepared for the business challenges, which are quite substantial and deviate substantially from technical problems, but they don't understand all of the technical issues. One of the places I love to go are incubators, business incubators, and I was at one in New York City mid-October, and I walked in. I was meeting a startup there to talk with them about what they were doing and see what I could do to be of assistance to them. And I walk in, and I'm, you know, 2 to 3 decades older than almost everyone in there. And as I like to joke, I'm dressed differently. I'm wearing a suit, I'm wearing a tie, and I know the right kind of male footwear for adults. And so people look at you a little bit, and then finally someone gets up courage and walks up over to you and say, "Who are you?" And I said, "I'm David Greer. I'm the incoming president of the IEEE Computer Society." And almost always, and this was certainly true in New York, they say, "Do you know software engineers?" And I say, "Why, yes, I do. I know lots of software engineers. Can you help us get one?" And one of the things these businesses have, they often have clear ideas, but they're having trouble getting the right technical idea for it. On another occasion, I was working with a publisher who contacted me and said that she had had this great idea. She had seen a friend with a smartphone and seen an newspaper application, and she thought she needed one for her publishing and described it, and I thought this was a great idea. And she said, can you get me a student to write it up? And I said, you don't want that. You're a professional. You're going off to do professional work. You're going to want something that when the student is long gone, that your programmer, someone else can pick it up and modify it and improve it for your next generation. Well, this is a woman who came into publishing. She was originally an actress and was in some fairly big films in mid-sized roles. But like with many actresses, the time ends, and she moved into publishing and proved to be very successful at it, but didn't know how to deal with software engineers. Her idea was really quite good, and I worked with her and helped her identify one. But you need to be able to do that without contacting the incoming president of the Computer Society. We need to have mechanisms and means for getting the right people to the right thing. And that also applies to some of the other things that we see challenges, getting capital to the right business. And this comes from the fact that often, in both business and in technology, we don't train our people to understand what they are doing with their business and their ideas and articulate it. I go to angel startups from time to time, and I have a very good friend who's been quite active in one in California, in L.A., and we all have seen the same thing. You see a young person standing up there, and she's pitching her idea for a business. And what comes out first is the cool technology, why this is so cool. And you have to explain to them that angel investors and venture capitalists don't really care about whether the technology is cool. In fact, they kind of get nervous if they do. What they care about is what investment is being pitched, not even what business. How is the idea going to improve their investment? How is it going to have a good risk-adjusted rate of return? And that involves flipping your technology presentation upside down and rethinking it and asking, what's the context for my idea? What's the market? How is this going to advance over 6 months, 18 months, 2 years, 5 years? And how will it produce a good benefit, a good business that benefits customers and employees and institutions and produces a return for the investors? And that's not obvious, and that's not straightforward to most business students and certainly technology students, that we need to do something to help them better make that pitch, better articulate what they're doing. And that leads me to sort of the third, I guess I'm on four now, aren't I? And that's really context, that in the ICT industry, we have for 65 years lived in a world where things change very, very fast, and yet we kind of look at ourselves only in a very narrow neighborhood. We say, the present is the world I'm going to live in. This is my idea. It's going to go forward in this way because nothing is going to change radically. And of course, this is an industry that has had radical changes time and time and time again. And, you know, and I mentioned the tablets and smartphones of the, you know, 2006, 7, 8 period that turned the industry upside down. My generation is the generation of the software industry. And when my father was telling me, you know, you are interested in computers, the way to get into computers, according to him, was to study the hardware, get a real clear sense of how it works, because those are people who understand machines. And I had zero interest in studying hardware. To me, software was everything. And I'm right at that cusp, the Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, and the others in the 70s, late 70s and early 80s, who built the software industry. And that change for us was obvious, and it wasn't for our parents. And we need to help people see across these changes and be prepared to adjust. And I think one of the reasons that my career has gone as well as it can is not that I had a beautiful, smooth arc, but when changes started to occur, I became intrigued with them and asked the question not only, what's the technology changing, but what's the framework around it? And, you know, the Internet, which moved into public consciousness between 92 and 95, that was clearly going to change a lot of things. And the interesting questions were not how is the technology going to work, but how does it interact with institutions? And being someone who started studying that and looking at it, one of my favorite studies of the period was I took a look at what to me is one of the first big political uses of the Internet, which was at the time of Tiananmen Square in 1989. The Chinese students who were protesting in that square also were connected to American and Canadian groups in the United States. There was a big one at Harvard, another one at Regina University, who were raising money for them, helping them think through issues politically, and doing publicity for them. And it was not a full Internet connection. It was a connection through various protocols that kind of limped through a German connection. but watching them coordinate activities and begin to discipline a global organization was, to me, one of the most revealing studies that I did at the time. And it was that disciplining a global institution when you can't see people, when you're not in the same time zone, and when you have to rely on certain cultural ideas to unify you, was just an incredible thing. And you have seen that idea play off through the 90s and the rest of the 2000s. And so that ability to put an idea in context, to me, is just a huge, huge thing. And I think the last one, the fifth one, is being caught up in our own hubris. The ITC industry has indeed done tremendous things to the world, brought great riches to places that did not have it, helped people with ideas. And I think Peter Drucker's prediction in 59 certainly holds true, that we moved into the idea economy, the economy where knowledge was important and applying knowledge was the path to success. But in applying knowledge, there's also the concept of wisdom. And wisdom is taking things into account that don't seem to be obvious, that involve listening for a context and a framework that may not be seen by the people there, and by thinking about good that's beyond the immediate benefits for yourself or your friends. And we think that we have changed it, and that's true. But I think we have, in that process, put ourselves in a position that fails to acknowledge the contributions of others. Business people are certainly one. Communications people, people who craft messages and are able to explain and teach and train. That's another group that I think we tend to overlook. I think the power of the social media is important, but it's not just the communication side. It's the people who are working together, sometimes in very humble ways, that help put it together and make it work. And when we go into problems, we often, the first question is, what's the technological solution? And we need at times to ask, what's the human solution? And how do we support and sustain that? And remember that it is people, that it's our society, that our institutions, our families, and even the individuals around us who are the ones we are serving, and that they have things to teach us, and that by seeing them with the power of this technology, we can multiply their good 1,000-fold, but we have to listen, and we have to look at what the society, the institution, and the human being need, rather than jump in with what a technical solution might look first. So those would be my five top challenges.
David, there's the other side of the coin. You know, you've clearly provided your insights on the top five challenges. Now, what are the top five opportunities for the ICT industry?
Well, I think the top opportunities in some ways mirror those five challenges. The first, I think without question, and you look out and you see expert after expert agreeing with this in their own way, the improvement and development and usage of human capital. It used to be that if you had an idea, if you had a skill, if you had a way of approaching something, you could only use that skill if you were living in a city, close to someone who had financial capital or part of an institution. And the ICT industry allows us to use people around the globe and bring them together in new combinations and new ways and get expertise that we couldn't touch before. And that, I think, is the big opportunity. It is something we have been developing. I think it's a little bit less than the entire history of computing, but certainly the last 30 years, and with the rise of the Internet, the last 20 have been very, very important. But it means that we have new perspectives that we don't have. Computing, though it very quickly moved out of the United States and the UK and Germany around the world, you know, by 65, we're seeing almost every country in the world have some interest in computing. It remained, for its first 20 years, a white male-dominated group, in part because a lot of the very early computers were placed in engineering schools, and that trained the next generation. But it is a universal tool, and it's one that can benefit everyone, no matter how they're trained, no matter if they've had traditional American Western-style engineering degrees or a humanities degree or a degree based in a very different cultural set of assumptions. These are tools that can help them. And the big advantage of the ICT industry is that it can lever those contributions, even if they don't fit into the traditional role and aren't physically located or socially directly connected to capital and organization. So I think that's without question the first one. And I think with that comes the second, that the opportunities of spreading wealth globally, of helping countries develop their ideas, their human resources, their physical resources, and do so in a way that's balanced, that's stable, that's transparent. I was in India just 2 weeks ago and attending their e-governance award ceremony in Calcutta, Kolkata, I was going to say. And it was really quite an inspiring activity because they were largely young men and women who had basic training in ICT and they had moved into a government office and given a project and were able to, with some dedicated work and some clear insights, transform some government process and make it better. And there was one that I saw was in a system that managed government contracts. And it made that process more transparent and more visible to people around it. And the first thing that happened is a bunch of contractors stopped billing the government 100% of the contract because presumably they had not done 100% of the work. They quickly dropped to 65 and 70%. And a whole bunch of contractors vanished because presumably they were just taking money and not doing anything at all. And the group was just so very proud of that because it had been a part of the country that had a reputation of being politically corrupt and of using contracts for cronyism. And that population didn't need to be burdened by, you know, what's in effect a tax or a weight on their government and on their society, that those resources could have been better used more honestly and more openly to improve their society. And I think that kind of transparency and openness is important. And then the third is related to all of these, that computing ICT technology is a coordinative technology. It allows people to work together in ways they couldn't before. And instead of having to muddle through a problem where you don't have an expert, you don't have someone who can solve the problem, you can use this technology to bring that expertise to your problem, to your organization, to your government, and help that improve the organization. I think the other opportunities involve, you know, something that we've been working on for 65 years, the organization and structuration of knowledge in a way that makes it easier for people to use. The big data activity, which is coming out, I think has great promise. I think it's, again, it's something we can overstate, and you hear a lot of people claiming soon we will know everything about everything. And in fact, the world is wide, that data often lies to us even when we try to collect it honestly. But it's our ability to see the world as a whole, to be able to understand what's happening to it environmentally, to the population and society, to understand the economy and where strengths and weaknesses and activities are to improve the economy. And one hopes being able to use this to, if you will, plug some of the holes in the environment, to protect ourselves from some of the damage that we are doing and have done to the environment and to society, and be able to improve our lot without using as much resources or as damaging society as much as we can. So I think that's just really a key issue, the organization of knowledge. And then the last opportunity is really the sense of efficiency and that the ICT offers. That when you have computing systems, I think that's the important thing to note. The key driving force of how we organize systems is this idea of continuous improvement. It's an idea that predates computing. It goes back to, in industrial culture, to American Telephone and Telegraph in the late 20s and early 30s. Walter Shewhart is generally credited with it, although he gave credit to others. That we take ideas and we build a system and then we look at it and we assess it and say, is it doing what it's supposed to be doing? Can we improve it? And with the idea that you are always trying to make things more efficient, to make the best use of resources, to be able to get things to as many people as you possibly can, to accumulate a wealth, and I think this is a sort of more broad idealistic wealth, for a society and an organization, to make it be able to do what it needs to do to support its people. And I just think that that idea of continuous improvement, of refinement, of developing systems that are never done, but are in fact always helping people advance, is really the last of the big five opportunities in terms of getting ideas out, helping people improve their lives, helping countries and institutions improve. These are the opportunities.
You know, we live in a complex environment, and there's many areas now in computing. It's just becoming quite specialized. Do you see any domains that in particular have the highest growth rates, you know, out of all the sort of specialties that are out there? And the reason I'm asking is that we have many professionals and they're trying to direct their careers with people in school and they're trying to figure out, hey, what am I going to do when I graduate? Which particular area of computing should I specialize in? Or you have people in mid-career are saying, you know what, this looks like an area that's not growing anymore. What are some of the opportunities that I need to direct my interests? And here we have the incoming president of the IEEE CS, and with all of your broad knowledge, you can bring that to bear and, to this sort of question.
Well, it's tough to choose five, to be honest. But I will do the best I can, and we'll discover that they're all kind of interlinked. I would start with big data. Big data is something that is starting to emerge into consciousness. It's been around for not quite 20 years. And it involves the collection of truly massive amounts of data from transactions in the economy, from social interactions, from environmental sensors, from all sorts of things, satellite, remote sensing, and being able to use these to make business, organizational, societal, political decisions. This involves using computing technology to work your way through the data and find truly interesting answers that are not discoverable by traditional statistical methods. This is something that's growing very, very quickly, and its applications are across the board. Economics is the obvious one, but helping to organize society, monitor the environment, make decisions about the environment, helping societies make decisions about educating the next generation and preparing it so that we don't lose generations to economic troubles. All of these are just huge, huge opportunities. We're only beginning to see what can be done with it. There was a conference I went to on big data. It's now about 14 months ago. It was a year ago last September. That you just sat there and the opportunities that were being laid out by speaker after speaker clearly showed that this could have a tremendous impact and that we were going to see that impact starting very, very quickly and growing throughout the field. So that's my first one. And it's related to a second one, which I'm going to call smart technology, which I relate to things like the smart grid. The smart grid being the shorthand notation we have for a refined, computerized system of generating, transmitting, and distributing electricity. The smarts of smart grids and other smart technologies are really twofold. One is the ability to codify and incorporate in software ideas and best practices for managing a variety of things, whether it is the generation of electricity or for the operation of an automobile or the management of an economy or business or anything else. So it's the codification and getting it in a form where people can use it, and particularly people who have not had the training or experience to get it originally. However, the second part of smart technology is the use of new mechanisms to help people, organizations, societies, schools, governments make good decisions. And often these mechanisms are market mechanisms. One of the key core things of smart grid, of the electrical, is the use of market mechanisms to help both consumers, generators, and transmitters make the optimal decision about the use of their resources. And for consumers, some of the things are obvious. Doing things in the middle of the night when generation is low. For transmitters, it's shuttling electricity to parts of the country or parts of areas in a place that they will get the most return and it's most needed at a given time to make the best use of their facility. And the thing about market mechanisms is that they're often quite good, and we know from the theory that they can produce the most efficient allocation of goods and services and get people to behave in good ways. But we also know that if you do them wrong, and if you have the wrong set of market rules, because all markets need rules, you screw them up. And you can produce shortages when you didn't mean to, misallocation of resources when that was not the intent, people misbehaving when you had no desire to have that happen. And that involves a clear use of both technology and understanding market behavior and getting people, you know, people who are, you know, 10 years into a career and have a good technical background, I would encourage them at this point to say, do some study of market behavior. We've seen them in the financial markets. How are we going to use it in the electrical markets, in the water markets, in the resource market? And we will see it applied to other things. I mean, we've seen it in London, for example. We now have a market mechanism for allocating streets. You can't go into downtown central London without your car license being photographed and being billed for it. We now have a very simple market mechanism that's done a fair bit of good to clean up downtown London. but we could be more subtle in how we use it and devise market mechanisms to make the best use of London Street or other streets or other assets that we have. So smart technology, and particularly in the use of market mechanisms, are important. The next thing that we're seeing is a big growth in what we're calling life sciences computing, applications of computing to medicine. And while the first thing that comes to mind, and the one that's often trotted out by, in America, the National Institutes of Health, are, you know, smart devices that are very expensive, that do things like, you know, monitor medical conditions or allow people who have a medical handicap to overcome it. Part of it is also, again, that idea of getting information to the individuals and helping them to make the best decision about their medical lives, about their needs and the needs of their family. And, you know, we have seen over the last 20 years the growth of a variety of medical information systems on the web where you can dial in and get information. But we've also seen in the last, 5 years, Facebook becoming a major source of medical information. And while there are elements of the medical community that get their back up and say, this is, of course, not good information, in fact, people transmitting information is ultimately one of the best ways, because you can have things that are attested to by someone in their real experience. It can also, you can get multiple people explaining a complex idea to you from a couple different points of view so that you understand it better. And this suggests a major shift in medicine of how do you communicate to a population to get ideas across broadly that they can help make their own decision and yet still have the kind of quality that the modern medical communities in the different cultures have maintained. And in particular, that idea of that there being different communities across cultures. You know, I live in the United States, and we have a fairly monolithic medical culture, and they view themselves as that's it. And I'm aware that once you leave that environment, there are a variety of other approaches. And how do you get the different communities to work together to identify practices that work well across the board? And how do we get it into a way that people understand it and people can use it? And I think this is just, you know, a very, very crucial tool, and it's one that's only going to expand. If we're going to number four, some people I think would have done this first, but I'm doing it fourth because I have members of my society who don't believe it's a field, and that's cloud computing. And the reason I downgraded a little bit and not put it first is that, as I said, there are members of the society who says this is just another form of parallel and distributed computing. There's nothing new here. It's just application. And I believe the answer to that is yes and no. Certainly, cloud computing is building upon ideas that have been developed really since, well, time-sharing took form in the early 60s. You know, one of the biggest things, the concept of a virtualized computer, where a computer becomes a software package that runs on another computer, and you can set up that computer, that is to say the software, the way you want it, and then when you don't need it, you store it. And if you need two versions of it, you duplicate it like you would a program, and off it runs. So these ideas are old, but one of the things about the application of them is that they allow very modest organizations and individuals use computing resources that are very, very sophisticated and complex because they don't have to pay for all of it. You know, I think of all the small businesses that now use them to have very complicated IT systems, but they don't use them very much because they're a small business, so they only pay for what they need. You know, in my consulting and in my work, I have a very sophisticated computing system that I broke away years ago from the university because they had their own interests and mine were slightly different. And I'm able to use all of these services because I just need one person's share of them, and I can afford that. I can't afford to have a big computing system that I run all the time that's idle much of the time. So I think that's clearly a direction of the future, and looking at consolidating data centers, how do you use consolidated data centers? How do you combine your work? How do you integrate all of this into a whole and make it work? And so I think cloud is without question just a major, major issue for someone looking ahead. And the last opportunity is a bit of a negative one, but it's still there, and that's cybersecurity and the protection of computing systems. The development of computing systems, certainly through the 70s and 80s, was led by people who thought alike, who had similar kinds of training, and didn't believe that computer crime, computer attacks, were going to be a major issue, that it was going to impose its own discipline on the users and the owners of this equipment, and that crime and problems would be rare. And of course, by the late 80s, we can see the first hint that it's going to be something substantial, and by 2000, it's become huge. The process of protecting computer systems couple special challenges in it. First, unlike defending a coastline, you can't just sort of put a group of airplanes and circle the coast and protect your computer system. Everyone's on the front line. Everyone is vulnerable. And so we need to help individuals to protect themselves. We need to provide the expertise, the skill, and the computer tools that are able to do it at the finest of level, and we don't begin to have it there. But the second thing is that computer security engineering, and it's a form of engineering, has its own discipline that's related to that of software engineering, but has its own special approaches, its own special ideas that shape it. And these ideas are things that at some level need to be carried into every home, every individual, every way we act. And this is partly an educational process, partially teaching how do people to use systems and how to engage them and how to think about them and manage themselves and manage their presentation of their information, their ideas, their data to the world. One of the elements of computers, of course, the big growth area for them is in embedded systems. That is to say, we no longer think of computers, less and less think of computers, as a standalone device. But they're things that are in our house, in our car, in devices that we use all the time, and that very few things are not computerized anymore. Virtually everything is in it. So we need to think about protecting our cell phone, our tablets, our cars, because it is possible that malware, software that was created for ill intent, can get in there and damage it. And yet at the same time, we can't expect every user to defend themselves about everything. So we need to build a society of trust, a cyber society of trust, that takes use of these embedded systems, which, as I said, are everywhere and are only going to get more common, and help us understand how to use them in our daily lives, how to use them to expand our power, our scope, our ability, and yet protect ourselves and our neighbors. Because when we do things to make ourselves vulnerable, we also make our neighbors vulnerable. And on the Internet, our neighbors can be anywhere in the world. So those would be my five opportunities that I would think someone mid-career or starting their career should look for as an opportunity to contribute to the industry and contribute to the world.
I remember an interview I did with Bill Miller, William F. Miller, and in fact, he now sits on this thing called the Global Industry Council, which I chair. And he's a provost, past provost of Stanford. Serial entrepreneur. He, in fact, was the first limited partner for the Mayfield Fund in Silicon Valley, and is responsible for many of the innovations that came out of Silicon Valley. In fact, is in the Silicon Valley Hall of Fame. And he talked about, I sort of asked him this question about, you know, what are some of the opportunities. Something that he also mentioned was working for nonprofits or contributing to a nonprofit because of all of the opportunities that you talked about, why people should get engaged. For example, the IEEE CS, the ability to network, collaborate, share, participate in this dialogue of moving the whole industry forward in so many different type of domains. So I'm just thinking, because you're the incoming president of the IEEE CS, perhaps that's also an opportunity of something that the greater audience, either mid-career, early in their career as students, they can become engaged.
Oh, I think so. And I think nonprofits have been for, you know, 30-plus years one of the major growth centers of industrial society. And they have become more and more professional and more structured. I think it was Peter Drucker who identified this in the early 80s, that we were increasingly dividing our lives in different ways, and we no longer expected one role in life to provide us with all that we needed. And also that we began to recognize that some of the services and ideas that we need in this world come from organizations that do it not for profit, that do it as part of a service to the greater good. And one of the things that ICT has allowed organizations that might have just been very simple or very crude or run by just a few people to expand their scale and scope without a great increase in cost, because they can get involved more people, they can deliver their services to a bigger group of a bigger community, and they can have a greater impact. And I think that that is just, the ICT has helped foster that, and it's going to be an area that is going to continue to grow in the future because of these needs.
I just want to make sort of one added comment. You know, as I mentioned, Bill is a serial entrepreneur in the Silicon Valley Hall of Fame, has started many, many companies. In fact, knows personally many of the founders of all of the big companies, the Fortune companies that are out there, because of the Silicon Valley connection that he has. But he also indicated that if you wanted to become a leader of a major corporation or have a great career success in corporate America or corporations around the world, he indicated one of the best training grounds was contributing to a nonprofit, because he said if you could lead a nonprofit, you can lead any company. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, Gartner, I guess about 8 years ago, came up with this concept of a versatilist, a multi-skillist. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that there's kind of this whole paradigm shift in the skills required for any ICT professional to be successful, and that is to have business experience, domain knowledge, interpersonal knowledge, plus technical skills. And again, they indicated one of the best training grounds was to contribute to a nonprofit in some way. So from a career standpoint, these are indicators that it's a great opportunity to push somebody's career up the up the curve, so to speak.
Right. Tom Watson Sr., the person who really made IBM what IBM became, had that as a principle for all his vice presidents, that they were all to choose one nonprofit and ask what did it take to make it a professional organization. And his was the organization that became United Way. That was the one he focused on. And again, it gave people opportunities to take leadership roles that they did not have at work, a chance to use skills that they couldn't develop from their jobs, and broaden their circle of friends, connections, and ability and framework to work. So I think that's exactly the right idea.
It's interesting that at the IFIP World Computer Congress in Amsterdam, and you were there, one of the themes was innovation. And there's the ISACA World Congress, which is held, which was held in June in San Francisco. Again, the themes were innovation, collaboration, execution, with the sort of focal point on innovation. And, you know, I had a long chat with Rob Atkinson, who's the founding president of the IT Innovation Foundation. And he talks about this whole idea that unless we do something about innovation, and especially in America, we're going to fall behind. And in fact, I think there's an innovation scale that recently came out, and the U.S. is ranked 12th, where before they were ranked in the top 10. So it's a big concern, and it's a concern in Canada and other parts of the world. Especially with emerging countries now putting a huge amount of their GDP into innovation and research. So from your perspective, as a leader of one of the greatest organizations on this planet, or what policies are needed to be implemented to foster innovation?
Well, Rob is the real expert on the policy for innovation. But the things that I see, and I've seen some of the same things that you have, you know, right now, if I were to say, where are my brightest students going? And the young people that I've had the contact with, they're still flocking to Silicon Valley. But it's Singapore that they're going. I've got three people right there right now. And I asked why they go there. And they said, because this is where it's happening. As I say, one of the key issues is making sure that we have the intellectual property policies right. Clearly, one of the issues of innovation is, one, the ability to play with ideas, to take things that you have found and put them together in new ways. And that, of course, demands more open intellectual property. Yet, at the same time, we need to give the incentives for people to do this so that they can put together a system, an idea, a product, a service, and expect to get some return on their work, that they can have some protection for it. So I think that issue of getting the intellectual property right is just crucial, and making sure that we have policies that don't stymie growth, that don't prevent people from playing with it, or at the same time are just so open that no one can expect a reasonable rate of return. I think the next thing is an issue that I've discussed already, is getting all the skills needed together in one place. You've talked about it with the multiple skill process before, but getting business skills, insight, managerial skills, technical skills, marketing skills, all of these things I think are crucial. And it's the old Tolstoy quote, you know, every good marriage is every bad marriage is unique, and every good marriage is exactly the same. The idea is that in a good marriage, you have to hit a whole bunch of qualities at a certain minimal level, and if you don't, it becomes a bad marriage. And to have a bad marriage, you just need to screw up one of them. It's true for companies, true, and true for innovation. To get it to work, you got to have a lot of things working well, and to not do it well, just screw up one, and you're over. It's over. And I think we have got to make sure that we are supporting the whole idea of innovation, that all the skills are out there and brought together. But as I said, I think one of the key ones is making sure that we have an intellectual property regime that does indeed foster both playing with ideas and combining them, and yet at the same time bringing real value to the people who develop them, and that they can expect a good return.
We have this this idea of accountants being certified and doctors and lawyers in some way, or engineers being licensed to practice, and they have a right to practice. Now, in the U.S. and internationally, what's happening with respect to software engineers and certification and licensing?
Well, the key thing that has driven software engineers for now 30-plus years, 35 years, has been the market. And the issue has, if you can do the work, we'll take you, because there's such a demand. There has always been a greater demand for software engineers than we have had software engineers to fill it. However, we have seen, really in the last 20 years, a focus on the idea that high-risk senior engineers need to be certified. And the people driving this are not governments. It's, to be blunt, insurance markets. It's if you're going to be borrowing a bunch of money to implement a system that has potential, the potential of doing great harm, then the leaders of that need to have some sort of certification so that the financial industry feels confident in them. Now, in the United States, that kind of work is traditionally done by what's called a professional engineering degree. And for a long time, computing professionals, not sure, resisted it so much as didn't pay attention to it. And over the last 4 years, we have seen software professionals put together a PE exam, and this is one of the highest standards you can get in American engineering, and set up within certain states the process of taking the exam. The exam is administered by a private organization and is usually done on a state-by-state basis. Texas right now is the biggest state for it. There's been a second need, though, which is for sort of mid-range professionals. And the reasons are somewhat similar, that these are people who need to demonstrate their skills and their ability. And in particular, because software projects often have a great flexibility, that you don't need the same skills throughout the entire time of it. These are people who need to move and need to have the credentials that say I am skilled, something that goes beyond a resume. The IEEE has been one of the leaders in that, using our software body of knowledge. And we have two major levels of certification. One that we call a computer system associate, and another that's called a professional. And these are two sets of exams that we offer through third-party people that we certify to identify the skills that people need and allow them to demonstrate it in an examination setting that will give them a certification. You see some of these ideas starting to move around the globe. The government of Malaysia is debating about a government-mandated certification, which I think will accomplish some of the same things. I think they may run the risk of seeing it sort of limit who can come into the field. But we will see how that works out. But increasing, we need to see the development professionals and the development associates identify themselves and be able to show through examination and certification that they are qualified, so that large projects, projects that need to have known skills in them, can do that. Now, this won't be for everyone, and there will always be a demand, as far as we can see ahead, for programmers and developers who get their skills through demonstration, through doing projects and being able to show it. But I think at the high end, we have reached a point where software is so pervasive that we will see first professional engineering degrees, largely for the financial markets, and then lower level professional certificates through people like the Computer Society that help individuals demonstrate their skills so that they can move to projects where they are needed with the skills that they have and can demonstrate.
It's interesting that you mentioned the certifications that the IEEE CS is supporting and has developed. I'm wondering what countries have the highest demand for these kinds of certifications. I imagine India, perhaps, or China. What's your perspective? Because you're global.
We're global. Clearly, right now, we see India as important, and primarily because they have this IT population that's growing hand over fist, and that they are training their people on the fly, that a very large fraction of their students come out of college with some training, but not prepared to be a system developer without 2 to 5 more years of additional training on the work, on the job. And so we have, you know, deployed 4 major certifiers in India primarily to meet this need, because so much development is starting to go on there, and that they need people who can say, not only I worked on this project and it seems to be fine, but also I have demonstrated the skills in a certified, organized way, so you know what I bring to the table. China is clearly the next market for that, but we see all of Southeast Asia as quite important. Singapore, South Korea, Japan are crucial markets. Since so many of the organizations are based in the United States, we see the high end as still being very, very important here. And we have been promoting the PE degree. We've been one of the leading groups behind it, the PE degree, the PE certification. But we also see the mid-level certificates being important here. It's sometimes in the United States hard to see this, but we have roughly 3 million, a little bit more, people involved in ICT professional work. And the bulk of them are in 9 states. And these places have just as strong a demand and just as rapid a growth as you see in India or in other places, but it's, you know, California, Texas, the area around New York City. These places as well need it because they're involved in crucial systems that need to be shown to be safe and secure. And the first step of doing that is making sure that the people who design it and implement it and test it are professional.
David, you mentioned Texas, and you also talked about California and New York. What states then in the U.S. are on this road to this PE degree certification, and I would say even licensing?
Well, Texas is the leader in the United States right now. And we see over the next 5 years the major states following. California, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Massachusetts, Florida, Illinois, Minnesota, that those will be the states that follow quickly behind. We suspect some of the smaller states that are trying to attract this industry may take a lead in trying to certify and professionals as a way of trying to get more investment in the area as well. But it's the big states that we're looking at, and as I said, Texas is taking the lead.
What are the risks then for software engineers with respect to the software they have developed?
Well, I think the biggest risk, you can go into all the details, but the one that we have seen, and I got into just a fascinating discussion with a colleague from MIT over the summer. We used to teach software development, as if you could ultimately, or someone could, hold the whole system in their consciousness, that they could have the overview and maybe individual members would understand each element completely. That day is gone, and MIT shifted its educational structure a little more than a decade ago, and other schools are following quickly. That we have now gotten ourselves in a defensive place where we don't know how, no one knows how an entire system works, and that you have to look at your unit in a defensive mode, that you can be given bad data, that you can put out a command that produces something you did not anticipate, that complex interactions will cause the whole system to behave in ways that no one saw. And of course, the risks are multiple. They can cause, you know, machinery to work badly. They can cause machinery to work in ways that threatens individual. Since, you know, so much of the electric grid is controlled by computers, and, you know, you think of what a couple megawatts of power can do if it's shunted into the wrong thing and a substation explodes. It can cause very real danger to individuals, and certainly can damage large parts of the infrastructure. You know, we saw in the recent Hurricane Sandy, we had several substations explode or were damaged in New York, and it took multiple days for them to come back online. That could just as easily have been caused by malfunctioning software. So the issue that we have is to get our software engineers and our developers working in that kind of defensive mode. How do you protect your part of the system from malfunction? And how, when you use other aspects of the system, do you design it to minimize the risk of something going astray? And it's the age-old issue. You try to avoid malfunctions, but if you get yourself in a malfunction, how do you bring the system down quickly and gracefully without damaging infrastructure and certainly without threatening the life and health of individuals?
Let's extend the last question to the liabilities for software engineers for the software they have developed.
Okay. I mean, I think really the liabilities, when you are a lead developer, you at some level have to take responsibility. And as we are seeing increasingly, we're seeing that the senior engineers have to take personal responsibility, that they have to have professional insurance for it. And that insurance requires them to demonstrate their skills, just as it does in any engineering profession, whether it would be a structural engineer or an electrical engineer or anything else doing something big. And so they have to look at themselves because they're, in effect, their livelihood, their assets, their home, their family are on the line. And to protect that and to protect themselves, they need that kind of financial insurance. Now, I think in certain parts of the United States and Europe, that's the most highly developed framework for it. But you also see it in Southeast Asia. Increasingly, that as software is being done on contract and there are relationships that are guaranteed by contract and that are enforceable, the leaders, the intellectual leaders, need to protect themselves because they are ultimately at risk. Because once you have a contract, they will specify limits of liability, but if the lead technical people violate that contract in some way, knowingly or unknowingly, that can pierce the veil. That can make the individual personally liable for failures. And once you get that involved, once that's involved, you get insurance. And once you get insurance, you need certification and a systematic way of demonstrating professional skill.
I guess another extension to this would be this whole idea of personal responsibility as a professional. Can you outline what these would be?
Well, I mean, the idea behind personal responsibility as a professional ultimately goes to the idea that you, and in fact no one, knows the ultimate outcome of your judgment. And in medicine is clearly, I think, the best example. Doctors give treatment according to their best understanding, and if they do something that harms the health of a patient or even kills the patient, they are spared personal liability if they have been acting as a professional, if they understand the best practices of medicine and followed those practices and tried to implement them to the best of their ability with the resources at hand. They're not personally liable. But if a doctor can be shown to have not been in tune with the best practices, to have known the best practices and not implemented them because they didn't have the material around or they were not fully trained in it or for whatever reason, they're personally liable. And that liability can go in a variety of forms. But it's fundamentally a liability that protects the professional against the unknown, against things that they could not have seen at the time, provided that they were using their best judgment and behaving like a professional, knowing what best practices are, engaging the professional community as best they could on difficult cases, and making sure that the treatment, the care, the design of the system, whatever profession we're in, was done to the best standards of that community. So when we look ahead for software engineers and software professionals, that's part of behaving as a professional. It's not merely, as I said, we often thought this issue of right and wrong. It's the issues of right and wrong are indeed tricky and require careful thinking. But it's beyond that. It's knowing best practices, and it's engaging the full knowledge of the community on problems that pose special risk and special danger to the public. We forget that when we talk about professionals, we're really talking about a professional community, and that the community always knows more information, always has a better grasp of a problem than any one individual has within it. And so when we talk about the responsibilities of the professionals, the responsibility is to use the profession, to use the best practices, to understand it, and to know how to use it, to get the best result and best protect the public.
You know, it's interesting. Yeah, you have traveled, or I should say, have traveled around the world and as of high. And we've spoken at various conferences, and we're engaged in different parts of the world in the respective communities that we represent. But there's differences in sort of ethical conduct and culture and so on, and that would have impact on liability. So how do the different jurisdictions, countries or states have different liability regimes?
Well, the different ranges, the different way that they look at regimes is really where they put the locus of risk. Who is taking the risk of the organization, of software development? And right now in most Western societies, the locus of risk is in effect at the point of investment. It's the organization that is funding it and anticipates getting a return on it. Now that's an organization, and that organization is expected to behave in, if you will, a professional manner in a way that prevents it by getting good individuals. And so that starts pushing the risk down into the organization, into the software professional, into the computing professional. And that's where you need to have risk. For the most part, globally, that risk is, as I said, it starts at the corporate investment level. And they're the ones who are financially responsible, and they push it down. We've seen various efforts and attempts to push the risk onto the individual. And I directly. And I don't see that over the long haul as being the key point. I see most countries, basically saying that it's the company, full organization that takes the risk. And that risk is then spread throughout the company, depending upon the different roles of the individual. I've been following this Malaysian case carefully, and I'm not quite sure of all the details, but I'm hoping that it doesn't, in effect, pull software professionals out of the company and say they have a special risk and we have to look at them, because I think that will ultimately be counterproductive if indeed that's what's going on. As I said, I don't see that at the moment, but I've heard that bubble up at several points, and I think that is a real risk, that once you pull the individual out and give them a special role beyond the company, that becomes a disincentive. The advantage of a company and an organizational structure for developing software is the idea that you're sharing risks and accumulating skills across a variety of individuals, and that they can work together as a whole better than any of them do individually. So the key thing I see is, at the moment, the locus of risk really needs to be at the organizational level.
I see this as now a question of also thresholds. So what kind of thresholds need to be crossed before liability and responsibility is incurred? Is it at the scale of undertaking? Is it based on the status of the professional, based on academic, professional qualification, registration, and membership in a professional society?
Well, I think first and foremost, it has to do with the scale of the undertaking in particular. It has to do with the scale of risk. You can very quickly put together some very small, very simple software systems that might run a large piece of infrastructure that, if they were to go astray, the damage would be huge, and that the risk, therefore, needs to be spread abroad, and we need to have a lot of people. I mean, what we do when we try to address risk is we try to spread it as broadly as we can, which means having as much expertise look as we can, enough as broad a group of individuals trying to assess what's going on, and a broad group of people willing to take the risk, take some financial risk as part of it. So it is, to me, the potential, the key threshold is the potential of damage, the potential of something going wrong. So when you reach that clearly identifies classes of jobs, but they're not easily identified by scale of corporation or scale of project, how much money is being invested in it, but more the inverse. If something went wrong, how bad would it be? You know, and for example, space flight remains one of the riskiest things we do, and the software involved in it gets tested many, many, many times. Yet at the same time, you think about it, very few spacecraft have the potential of damaging large amounts of people, that the risk is fairly well contained within it. We know, you know, the expected value of a payload and what the expected return would be over a period of time. And so that's an example of something that reaches a certain scale, and it certainly reaches a certain scale of difficulty and touchiness. But at the same time, the financial risk is contained. But if you look at a telephone system, an electrical system, any one of these large public infrastructures that's controlled, for many of these, the risk can slide towards being unbounded. The amount of fiscal damage that could be done is very difficult to put in a very fixed box, as you would with a spacecraft launching. And it seems to me very clearly it's that kind of thing that demands it first and foremost. Things where the fiscal loss is difficult to bound. And once you have that, then the other pieces start falling in place. The kind of people you need for it, why they need to be certified, why we need to validate them, how the testing process needs to be certified or validated in a similar way. And that's the issue to me. How is the risk unbounded, if it is unbounded?
Earlier, you discussed about, you know, this whole idea of liability and it being mitigated by adherence to best practice, and use example of doctors, and you know, and then sort of extended it to software developers. So then this kind of produces other questions, like how much can best practice be codified, or and what are different kinds of software engineering, software development best practices, and I know what kinds of liability are civil versus criminal in nature, and upon which party is either case lies the burden of proof, and what social processes can be established to learn from software engineering, software development failures to emphasize learning from mistakes.
Yeah, and I think that's really gets to the issue of what does it mean to be a professional? Each aspect of a field, and if we can just, you know, contrast and compare medicine and law, which are two very different fields, both have their own sense of what best practices is and what the best practice of a professional is and how it relies on it. And those sense of what the best practices are were developed by the profession in the field, by people working in it. Software development and software engineering have very similar forms of what best practices are. And yet we might be able to split a difference between them and find different sorts of things. But best practices are codified by a community, by a broad-based group of people who are combining expertise across time and place and circumstance to understand how the field works, how decisions need to be made, and what ideas tend to produce the best results. So there's a great deal that can be codified, but the code has to be, one, dynamic, because circumstances change. And second, it has to have a way of people looking at it and recognizing when something that they thought was once a best practice, in fact, has so many liabilities in it that we can't subscribe to it anymore. We have to have mechanisms for rejecting old best practices. And so that involves basically a community that debates, a community that debates in public. The kind of institutions include things like the IEEE Computer Society, but also standards organizations like the American National Standards Institute, ANSI, or ISO. And again, if you look at these organizations, they too have a process of getting ideas to the front and doing it in a transparent way in which ideas are debated very, very publicly in standards, which are a form of best practice. Everyone basically has to put all of their interests on the table, intellectual property interests, their corporate interests, whatever they have. And then when they argue about something, the arguments have to be above board. And you can question things by trying to probe and ask, you know, is this really what they're saying? Are they doing it because they have a financial interest or something else? The best arguments are done on the issues in public. And this is what produces it. Now, the civil versus criminal really boils down to intent. If you are doing with an intent to deceive in best practices, that immediately flips you into the criminal world. There are forms of ignorance where you have not been keeping up with best practices that can do that as well. But it's really sitting down and proving that someone purposely ignored a best practice, they reinterpreted it in a way that benefited them, that they manipulated the best practice. It's the intent that gets to you. And of course, that becomes very difficult to prove sometimes, but nonetheless, that's really the dividing line. But often the civil, the fact that the best practices were not used and through ignorance or through whatever purpose is usually enough to keep the focus on the risk and appropriate kind of professional behavior. The social processes to learn from failures. I think we actually have a lot more experience in this than sometimes we give ourselves credit for, because these are the standard-making bodies that have it. These are the professional organizations that develop things like the SWEBOC, the body of knowledge, or the certification exams. And the processes, I think, you can get a good sense of them from the ANSI standard process, which talks about what's effectively a multi-step process, where the people come to it and they identify themselves, they put their issues on the table, they frame the questions in a certain way, they bring debate, they get to things through consensus, and that they produce reports that both indicate the positive nature of the standard and often a minority report or a negative report that critiques it and points to issues that need to be addressed. These processes have worked very well over the long term. They, of course, have failed in short term and failed in specific examples. But we learn from that because the goal is getting the best practice out there and making sure that the community knows it and limits mistakes. And relatively speaking, if you start thinking about what would happen if we did not have these processes and the amount of chaos that we would face, I have an example I often use. About 5 years ago, I was in my office and the power went out and I sat there for a little bit and it didn't come back on. And it had happened that a bus had run into something at a power station and knocked out our whole neighborhood. And so I got out and started heading for home. And I was on the leading edge and was able to get to the subway faster than everyone else. But what was fascinating was the fact that people went to their cars, and within 10 minutes, all the streets were in gridlock because there was no coordination of the stoplights, that you could let one person through and they got the next one and they stalled because the one ahead wasn't organized. There was no timing. The police and the good people who were trying to direct it couldn't coordinate their activity because they had no power. And it took like 10 hours for a relatively small neighborhood to clear itself of cars of people going home. And we forget that we do have means of coordinating activities, coordinating best ideas, coordinating professional concepts. And without them, we would have complete and utter chaos. And the fact that occasionally we see failures and or certainly see shortcomings doesn't really negate or say that these processes are failures. They are working, and over the long haul, they have tended to do far better than no process at all or the alternative.
Now, what are the risks and liabilities of the software developed and then considering these items, such as contracts for commercial or open source development, and then should be specific about product liability, IP and copyright issues, independent contractors' use of systems such as professional standard schemes to cap liability, and testing protocols minimizing risk of rogue developers and benefiting from the using appropriate methodologies such as Agile and Scrum?
Oh, wow. The risks are not just, you know, systems going astray. I mean, you hinted several of them. You know, there are IP risks where you use something that you think is in the public domain and it isn't, and you're stuck with it, and you have done something inadvertently. To me, the first set of risks are the risks of doing damage, the risks of harming. And that harm can either come in physical harm or disrupting systems. You think of kind of the harm that would happen to a business system or a financial system if it were disrupted and didn't work properly. So that's the first one. And I think that's the first one that we have to make sure that our professional systems are prepared to address. Excuse me. But in this world, we have a second set, as you identified, IP and copyright issues, that we have material that's been produced out there that people have rights to, and that you can directly or inadvertently use those rights. I think that's something I, you know, raised earlier, to making sure that we have got systems involving intellectual property that encourage development, yet at the same time allow people to get their the value out of what they have contributed. This is a tough one because we've seen increasingly groups of organizations that are now investments that are there solely to extract rights from people using ideas. And that makes some of the development difficult. And in particular, in the use of intellectual property, it's been overwhelmingly used as a barrier, as a means of keeping people out of markets and keeping people from creating things that might threaten another product or another service. This kind of work, that kind of thing, is not necessarily handled by professional work, but by legal work of keeping a careful watch over where software is coming from, what ideas are out there, and knowing the literature. It has a professional side to it because it's difficult to do without really understanding how software is developed. But this is why big organizations who are doing large systems keep intellectual property lawyers busy scrubbing and looking over how systems are developed. The independent contractors, that's an increasing issue because when you're employing software developers and software engineers, increasingly you need mid-sized and small projects. You don't need a full-time developer engineer. You need someone for a period of time. And so with that, you are getting someone with a contract and using the contract to share risk. Since it's being done by small and mid-sized companies, often our understanding of how the instruments, the contracts, and the agreements that we have are not complete, and sometimes put the onus of the problem on the wrong place, on the too much is on the contractor, for example. And we've started to see, you know, the professional standard schemes and others starting to say this is the best practice, this is how you protect all the parties involved. But if you're working as an independent contractor, this is one of those things where I think thinking very seriously about professional insurance and how you protect your own assets are important to do, particularly as now we have a global market for software developers and software engineers, and you may be working outside of your jurisdiction. Your actions may be governed by some other set of law that you don't understand, and making sure that you have insurance that covers that is, I think, important. The rogue developers. That's an interesting issue that I'm not sure we have entirely come to grips with, and we're still dealing with a world where there's so much work to be done that we often take people that we shouldn't. Again, I think we need to think of these things as being the locus of the risk being at the point of the organization that is developing it. And the way to minimize it from their point of view is, in effect, to hire people who are certified, people who you know where they have been, you know the training that they have had. And that also brings with it the sense that they are using the appropriate kind of methodologies. We do in software development still have this grab onto new ideas that are popular for the moment. And some of them are, in fact, good development techniques. Some of them are slight variations on the standard software lifecycle development technique, which is really the core of all development. But some cut corners, and they bubble up for a while and don't always produce the best software. And again, the professional certification, the holding to a professional set of standards helps to minimize that. And in particular, in an organization where you have one unit as your development, one person in charge who's your locus of control of that, you can start enforcing those software standards, those professional standards, and using them to help bring that risk under control.
Now, this is quite an extensive sort of series of questions, and I'm just going to give them all to you. And that is, what are the general issues in these five areas? Firstly, definitions of software engineering and software development. And one would presume usually software engineers would be or would have responsibility for software development or software developers. Secondly, off-sourcing software development and contract management. Out of jurisdiction, of organizations' headquarters. What are the human resources and legal issues? The international languages of programming and breaking down barriers across culture and ease of mobility for individuals globally. The fourth item, upskilling of new developers and maintaining existing and the aging workforce to maintain legacy systems. And finally, for the fifth item, rules of engagement in open source development, things like payment, accountability, reliability, and changing business models regarding how software is commercialized.
Yeah, well, you laid out a whole bunch of them there. Let's start with the software engineering and software development. Software engineering is the term of art. We have an international standard for what a software engineer is and what a software engineer does. One of the most important things software engineering does is software development. So indeed, that's usually what you see is in charge of it. Software engineers also, though, not only develop software, they test it, they refine it, they improve it. So it's a bigger set of skills. But software engineering is indeed a term of art where software development is kind of a subset of it and is not as well defined. The outsourcing, offsourcing software development issues, these are really global labor issues and global contract issues. And they are really need to be handled by legal professionals in the field. So if you're doing this sort of work and you're not familiar with how it works and don't have professional support, you really need to go in that direction. And that, I suspect, will be a set of skills that will never really be part of the software engineer. It'll be skills the software engineer needs to use. The international languages of programming, I think, is an intriguing issue. I mean, as you know, in international air travel, English is the language of air traffic control, and it's done to minimize problems, that if you have one standard language or one set of problems, that you're always going to be able to communicate with your pilots, whereas internally, countries rely on a variety of languages. As we look ahead to software, really starting to think of, are there standard languages that we need to codify? Right now, the standard languages, things like Java and C++ and the rest, are codified by usage, by codified by investment. Is there value in international systems of having something beyond a system-by-system codification of the protocol, the languages, and the other aspects of the descriptions of systems? Right now, I think that's done primarily at a contract, project-by-project basis. And I think if we're to look at bigger systems, and particularly systems that do transcend boundaries easily, telecommunication systems, data communication, that we may need to look at structures that go beyond just contract by contract or country to country, that do represent a multilateral framework. The upskilling of developers, this goes back to what I argued earlier, that the human resources of development and engineering are the key issue. And that's exactly right. How do you transform your human resources, your staff, your workers, in ways that keeps them up to date and keeps them valuable? While I was in India a couple of weeks ago, I talked with one of the senior reporters of the Times of India, and he shared with me an article that he had written that had the headline, Technical Degree Has Shelf Life of 5 Years, and it had 600 comments on the blog, and the people were angry and upset. And I read it, and I said, I think you've been, nailed by your copywriter, by your headline writer, because I don't think the article supports the headline. A technical degree has a career ahead of it and a valuable career. The programming hands-on development work is often very short and done by young people, in part because of the physical demands that it requires. It often demands someone to have a focused, sustained concentration for 6 or 8 hours at a time, sometimes longer. And that's not something everyone can maintain, and it's really done best by people in their late 20s and early 30s. But that's not to say that the rest of their career is not valuable, because it is, because it has more experience, more understanding, a broader base of skills. And managing that career, that technical career is hard. We don't do very well, and we haven't thought much about it beyond the kind of refresh idea that we have to give people new courses on new ideas. And we forget many, many things in the process. One, that people learn differently at different stages of their lives. Second, that life experience changes that learning process and also changes the mental model behind it, the thing that we're using to plug that information into. And that what we thought was important as a 20-something is not the same thing we think is important as a 40-something. And that we need to think not only of managing the software life cycle, which we've gotten pretty good at doing, but the technical human resource life cycle, and recognizing all the value at all the different stages. And just as you would not turn a 22-year-old programmer loose on a high-risk system that had a lot of subtleties to it, at the same time you wouldn't demand a bunch of 40-somethings to program from scratch in a language and concepts they don't understand, a system that demands a quick and fast turnaround. So it goes beyond that. It is really managing the human life cycle as a human career. And we're not there yet, and we're not even close. And then finally, the rules of engagement in open source development. I believe that open source is very important to our field. It won't be everything, but it has a way of presenting, of conglomerating ideas and skill and knowledge into a single place and allowing that community to use it at reduced costs and allowing people to take skills that they cannot widely use and use it in a specific problem for the benefit of a large group. Now, in fact, if you start getting to it and start looking at the big open source projects, all of them have institutions behind them that sometimes get invisible. If you look at, for example, the Mozilla web browser, that's perhaps a little bit clearer because that used to be a for-profit company, and it's now a non-profit company. But it gives a locus, something to hold the assets. It provides a means of controlling it, of managing the change of the system, and of recruiting people to support that management. So again, we now have an organization that takes the risk. Now, since in theory, open source involves free distribution of software, that organization needs to come up with a way of financing the risk and of protecting itself. And people like Mozilla and Linux and the others have found ways of generating revenue primarily from downstream companies that benefit from their work. But they need to do that. And it's really mostly the same set of rules and the same kinds of problems you had to have in for-profit development. The prime difference is that you're dealing with different kinds of contracts for distributing the software. And the fact that we now can say we've got, you know, 24 or so different contracts, I'm not sure they are all that different, but certainly 4 or 5 major forms of open software development contracts, points to the fact that people have begun to understand the risk and put together legal instruments for mitigating. And the fact that, you know, for example, things like Android, the operating system for a large bulk of our smartphones, is based on open source development, shows the fact that we do have mechanisms for mitigating this risk in a way that certainly large, wealthy corporations that could be vulnerable can accept and can work with.
What are your comments on these issues in software engineering from a career development standpoint, the scarcity of master's programs, and secondly, the lack of specific professional development?
Oh, I this is stuff that bothers the computer society right now tremendously, and we have been for 5 years putting a lot of resources into this, and we're going to be putting more resources as we go ahead. Career development, the scarcity of master's programs, and the uniformity of master's programs. Now, first off, in the software development level, they don't need to be uniform because there are a variety of different jobs to fill. But having a career development plan that is based on an overarching model of software development is important, and we see professional organizations as playing the central role. It is entirely plausible that engineering accrediting organizations such as ABET or its equivalent in Europe may step into it, but at the moment we simply don't see that it's a professional question and that the professional societies need to start saying this is the standard for what we would consider a master's level developer worldwide. The lack of specific professional development is deeply tied into that. And one of the things that we are fortunately now in a position is being able to make and develop materials that we can distribute using internet and other technologies globally. And in particular, we've seen, and I heard this in India all the time, that in professional development, pure e-learning, distance learning techniques does not work. You have to combine e-learning with a real on-the-ground instructor so that you can deploy common curricula, common ideas, common tools globally, and certify local people to help with the development and put together a true global professional development structure. And I think that's very much what we're looking at doing. We've made strong advancement in that in India and are working on the same issue in China. And I suspect 5 years from now we'll be able to show a world of advanced education, of continuing education and career development that's quite different from the one we have today.
It's interesting. And from the educational side, do you see a role for this thing called the Solo Cord?
Yes, of course. But I think we see sort of a variety of institutions coming in and trying to see how to use it, how to develop it, and how do we reach the individual. I think our point of view from the computer societies is our interest is the individual worker. And I think there are other organizations that are starting to look at the institution, the company, the organization that develops software, and one step beyond that, the community that uses a product or a group of products, and how all these pieces fit together are really going to be the questions of, certainly more than 2 years, but sort of 5 to 7 years, of how we start to see this. Because when you have a global market, a global workforce, and a global consumer base, then you have to have global standards.
For the benefit of the audience, I should just provide a quick overview of the Solo Accord. Probably say it's sort of like a multilateral agreement among different countries and their accreditation bodies to have some alignment of tertiary education, and that is post-secondary education, so that in some way they can sort of follow common guidelines and have some kind of recognition. And ultimately this leads to, I would say, some kind of conformity or standardization in computer science education.
Yeah, and I think that's true. I think one of the issues is, one of the many issues, is the different countries and the different regions look at where the point of professionalization is in different places. Some look at it as a master's level, some look at it as an undergraduate level. And one of the things that is going to be useful in going ahead is getting something close to a fixed point for that. I think the work to get the undergraduate level, which I think will ultimately be the entry point for a professional education, is going to be hard enough. And once that's done, they can look at master's level and leadership level. But that's going to be ahead, and as I have suggested, I think the professional organizations are going to be taking the lead on that for the time being.
As the 2013 incoming president of the IEEE CS, you're perfectly positioned, in my opinion, to describe where you see the certification market evolving in 2 years and in 5 years.
Yeah, and I think I've gotten enough hint that what I would like to see in 2 years is probably going to be 5 years, but that the marketplace is moving in a good way. I think the certification marketplace is largely going to be handled by a group of organizations such as the Computer Society, developing standards and certifications, and then working with local organizations on the ground to deliver training for those certifications and the certification process itself. I think within 2 years we will see a good strong footprint in India and in some other parts of South Asia and Southeast Asia. I think in 5 years we will start seeing this thing really be global, and that people being able to move across the different cultural and country barriers with certifications that are recognized around the world.
Our audience of ICT and business professionals are bombarded with so much information out there, and a lot of it's spam or noise. And so I'm always curious as to what significant leaders like yourself use as your top resources, and perhaps they can learn or also utilize those same resources.
Oh, cutting through noise is the hard thing, and I'm not sure I claim that any of these does it. I have a number of blogs that I follow. I do look at a number of the big commercial sites, such as the IDG sites and Wired and things like that. Obviously, as part of the Computer Society, I pay very close attention to what we produce and what the IEEE produce. But one of the things that has become clear to me in all of these is the limited nature of each of them, that you really have to look across the board and that you have to, that your judgment is used in reconciling and unifying these. Because of my position at a university where I'm an international affairs and international policy professor, I spend a lot of time with that literature, and one of the reasons I like it is not that I pay attention to the politics or who's doing what, but it gives me a context, an international business context. And for example, when I started to see my students going off to Singapore, it made perfect sense to me because I had started to follow the information on what Singapore was doing in developing its industry, the high-tech development park that it had created north of downtown that is really second to Research Triangle, if that, as a source of innovation in this world. And it's, for me, the interesting question is putting the pieces together. And in particular, I'm very aware that what I get in blogs and in tweets is raw material. And I appreciate it when it directs me to other things. But for me, the work is putting all the pieces together in being the person that weighs and judges the different pieces.
This question is probably very difficult. I mean, who could have anticipated the impact of smartphones or even tablets? And you can see the ramifications with RIM and Nokia and others.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be tremendously agile today, very aware of the environment, doing a continual SWOT analysis, strength, weaknesses, opportunities, threats analysis, but probably on a weekly basis to stay productive and to grow. So from that perspective and that context, and I know it's going to be difficult, but what do you see as maybe some of the top disruptive technologies that will be coming up or disruptive ideas that are coming up and the kind of impact they will have?
Well, obviously the mobile embedded systems are the things that are pushing forward and will have the power to change. The things that I've been paying attention to are the variety of sensing devices that we're starting to put in these and what they mean for us. I think prior to the smartphone, the idea of having an accelerometer in your phone was just completely unheard of. Why would anyone want to do that? And yet we can clearly see that having something that detects the motion of the phone is important and is being used increasingly. So what other pieces of sensors are we going to be looking in there that will be useful in terms of getting the environment? You know, obviously there are heat and humidity and other environmental things. But are there more things that we can start seeing that will radically disrupt? We've been, you know, talking about this idea of having a smart home, which I've written several times as sort of like putting your parents in jail. You know, you can trace every bit of motion of what is going on with them. But I do think that we're going to see deployments of sensors and deployments of things that will change the way we use the home in ways we can't quite understand. Certainly, you know, 8 years ago, we started deploying taxi cab management systems that located all the cabs, located what they were doing, and it's produced a much more efficient transportation system and one that keeps the drivers busy, which, despite the fact they're being looked at and they kind of cross about that, are generally happy that they are earning more money. And I think we'll see that kind of thing where we have assets that have IP addresses, that have controllers and sensors that help us understand what they're doing at a distance and allow us to use them better. I've been a little bit intrigued, you know, with the humble RFID tag, the radio frequency identification tag, that, you know, we've been using this on products and goods and services for 15 years. And seeing it that every now and then bubble up into something new that can be scanned or tracked wirelessly with just a little tag, and where that can go and what that might end up changing how we deliver goods and services, how we coordinate activities. Personally, the other big thing that I've been paying close attention to is the crowdsourcing ideas, the use of the expertise of large numbers of people. There are a lot of fairly narrow definitions of it, and I think it's actually quite a large phenomena to the point that I think we'll forget about it, we'll lose track of it, it just becomes part of everything. But how do you engage a community? And the tools that you use involve market mechanisms, it involves some of the things we think of as brand management and public opinion. There are a lot of elements in it, and as I see it, it's going to change the way we think about dealing with goods and services and organizations and interactions with the community, and will have us, in effect, connected to more and more people, sending smaller or minimal pieces of ideas around, but using that information and idea to make judgments about how we act and how we can act best for ourselves and best for the world at large. So the sensors, the use of data and large data, the use of crowds and human data to help have substantial impact and substantial disruptive impact over the next 5 to 7 years.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned this whole idea of crowdsourcing, and it kind of brings to mind this concept of EverQuest. You know, the game's 5 million users mm-hmm. are being used to model economic behavior.
Yep.
And then there's this game called Foldit, where they can determine how proteins fold into enzymes. And within 2 weeks, they're succeeding, where microbiologists and supercomputers have failed over many, many years, and many of the gamers are in middle school. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of interesting sort of tapping into all of the resources that are out there just amongst people or even in investments. There's a company called CapLinked, which is bringing out this whole investment idea and crowdsourcing it, or the U.S. Jobs Act, mm-hmm. Jumpstart or Business Startups Act, which supports crowdfunding.
Yep.
And then all the ideas that you're talking about kind of also brings to mind maybe, you know, the recent patent filings for Microsoft and their glass technology, or Google Glasses, which is now going to be released, and this whole idea of augmented reality, and it's going to be born and worn. And I guess it talks to the smartphone and all the other embedded kind of technologies that you talked about earlier. So it's a pretty exciting world, but it also triggers this idea of MOOCs. I don't know if you've been following that miracle, or I don't know, maybe it's not a miracle, but it seems to be a lot of controversy. I mean, do you think MOOCs is going to be a game changer?
Well, in some form. Whether it's that exact form or not is not clear to me. But the idea of we live in the information age and we'll be getting more and more information out in more and more ways seems to me quite obvious, and that we'll see undergraduate and graduate courses. I think some of the numbers we have seen are misleading, because I think underlying it is a long-tailed behavior that will have a lot of people intrigued with it, look at it, engage it a little bit, but that the number of people who complete it and get certifiable knowledge out of MOOCs will be small. Now, I think it'll be larger than what we're seeing now in conventional delivery, but that we need to remember that it's going to be pushing it out at a sort of a justifiable growth, if you will, rather than a radical change all at once. You know, I've seen a number of organizations, and I do it. I take my course materials, and I just hang them out on the public for any to see. And I teach a course of, you know, 20 people, and I have a couple hundred following the class along from the outside. Just, they've discovered my stuff, which I don't advertise all that much, and they read it. They don't get the test. They don't get the discussion. And I think this points to the key issue that we're seeing in the balance of all this phenomena, whether it's games with a purpose, whether it's crowdsourcing, whether it's MOOCs or anything else, that there is information, that there are ideas that can be transmitted, that can be abstracted and transmitted over the Internet and processed with ITC technologies, and that there is human knowledge, and that that human knowledge involves understanding the way a human being is thinking, knowing how to reach that, knowing how to use metaphor, analogy, touch, whatever, to get another human being to react, to see something in a new way, to learn something, to produce something, to engage something. And that try as we might, there's going to be a division line between the things that we can do easily with ITC and help coordinate that human activity, and things in which needs that sense of human imagination, that ability to perceive beyond what you can easily process with data and abstraction, what other human beings are thinking. And the real interesting question and the real interesting disruption is, how do those things divide? How do they split up, and how do you end up at the end of the day with systems that use the deterministic structural abstractions of ICT to do work, and how you combine that with human insight, with effective knowledge, and other things that allow people to understand and guide people.
Again, for the benefit of the audience, I guess I should define MOOCs, and that's massively open online courses, and probably the sort of the uptake came last year in the fall when Stanford released a massively open online course on artificial intelligence, and they had 160,000 students register from over 190 countries.
Mm-hmm.
It was translated into 40 different languages, and I believe they had something like 200 registered on campus, but this quickly dwindled to under something like 30 within a few weeks because they preferred the online platform.
Yeah, and I think if you look at it, I mean, that was an example of it, that the number of people who completed the course was an order of magnitude less than 190,000. I believe it's around 2,000. And the people who were largely testable out of it was less than that, who could demonstrate it. But it was still more than they did in the original version of the class, substantially more. And I think, just as, you know, we saw in the old newspaper age, that people would get a full newspaper, but very few people would read the whole thing cover to cover, that MOOCs represent putting out a body of knowledge in a form that people can get at it, what they need out of it. And one of the things about MOOCs is they've figured out that about the optimal segment for a MOOC lecture is about 6.5 minutes long, so that you'll have courses that might represent, you know, 35 hours of contact time, which is an undergraduate course in the United States, divided up into 6.5 minute units. And that people will use those, and there will be a large group of people who will get something out of it and use it. There'll be a smaller group that gets through the bulk of it, a smaller group than that that does all of it, and a smaller group than that that has done it well and detailed, is testable at it, and can go to the next level. But the point is that that knowledge represented that course by going off to that distribution of people still represents more people having that knowledge than those who had it from the original course, which might have been 20 people.
As one of the leading authorities in ICT and as a noted professor and also a industry leader, are there areas of controversy that you can talk about?
Well, one of the first ones we've already touched on is that is how do human beings fit into global computing systems? Is it exploitation? And just because we're using new technology doesn't mean that we are using the ideas and labor of people always fairly and always properly. Now, one of the things I think will come out of this is we'll start looking at various skills and recognizing that some of them, when put across the globe, are going to be difficult to use to earn money, even though that they contribute to something. Certainly not a lot of money. But at the same time, as we see, particularly in this transitional period, as we're deploying these technologies globally, there will be opportunities to exploit workers in the short term because of low-wage areas or desires to connect and use systems outside of their home countries or home region. And I think we do have to be very cautious about exploiting, about taking the value of someone's work at less than it would command globally. But I think at the end of the day, we're looking at creating a global infrastructure that coordinates the work, the physical work and mental work of people around the globe. And once you do that, that immediately breaks into a controversy of how do people fit into it, how are they compensated, what say do they have over their own business. The traditional issue between political decisions, things that happen in a region where you're a citizen, and employer relations, where you are part of an organization that you're associations at some level voluntary, and the rights and requirements are substantially different. These are issues that, you know, have been debated in very public ways and sometimes very violent ways at different points in world history. And we're now entering into a period where we are conceivably putting a large chunk of the global population in this framework. That's a global ICT framework where you can coordinate and work and engage people globally and engage people where you are not politically represented, but you may have an employee relationship or some other kind of relationship. I think that's just going to be a big, fascinating argument that's going to go on for a while. I think there's also the issue of privacy that is going to be a key issue. There's the classic quote, I believe it's associated with Bill Joy, of privacy's over, privacy's finished, get over it. But there are aspects of privacy that are still important to people. Medical privacy is a classic example. The world does not have a right to know what health issues you may be struggling with and how you are approaching them. It does not always have a right to know your income and how you are deploying that income and how the kind of life that you are living. And how do we make sure that citizens have a right to a certain kind of privacy and are maintaining that right is maintained. Yet at the same time, individual actions, of course, can touch on global issues, and people can hide behind privacy when they really should be out in the public. So privacy is going to remain a discussion, and I think the technology will outstrip it, but that we still have a right and an obligation to discuss it and make sure that that's argued. There are other things as well. Obviously, this technology redistributes wealth, and is it doing so in a way that values the contributions of all? The these are the kind of issues that I see coming up. They're human issues primarily, and issues of individual standing, of individual representation, of how the individual relates to the greater community. And is it a political community, you know, with a sense of citizenship? Is it an employment community? Is it something else? And those are the kind of issues that I see as being controversial and being as very difficult to resolve.
There are global and national and regional professional associations. So what is the value for computing professionals to belong to a professional association?
Well, I think it's the key issue. You know, I've hit with it on community. We, professional community is a different kind of community. It's not an employment community. It is not a national community, a citizenry community. It's a community of people who are devoted to promoting and supporting a body of knowledge. And by being part of the community, that community, you have access to the body of knowledge, and you have access to the others who support it, who help you understand what are best practices, how you should work, how you should behave, and how you should present that knowledge to the public. If you are involved in the kind of high-risk computing, the computing that does indeed have global impact, I think the value for the individual is that it increases your ability to have an impact by giving you access to more and more knowledge, but also because it gives you a community that supports you, that helps you understand what is the right way to behave, the right way to work, the right way to present ideas, the best practices. And that's the value I see in it. And I see it, the biggest value as being at the global level, since with all this technology, we are creating a global community.
You know, you talked about Malaysia, and that has generated some controversy because of what they're trying to do, and they're trying to sort of, I would say, codify computing as a profession. So what are your views about that? Do you feel computing should be a recognized profession on par with accounting, medicine, and law, with demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics and a discipline process for those who breach it, personal responsibility, public accountability, quality assurance, and recognized credentials?
I do, but I would sort of stretch out those different fields. It's probably closest to accounting, in that accounting is a field that works pretty much within the frame of corporations and organizations. You know, we have independent accountants, but their goal is to help organizations work, and that they have a group of rules about how they behave with respect to them, with respect to their peers, a body of knowledge. And certainly I think computing has a similar responsibility, since so much it does affect business processes, organizational processes, coordination of human activity. That certainly has a clear parallel. And all the things that accounting has in terms of best practices, a form of educating its members, disciplinary procedures, I think all of those are things that we will develop. Now, we're hampered by it in that there is a greater demand for computing services professionals than we supply. So that tends to lower the bar and means that organizations hire people who may not be fully certified or may not have gone through it. But I still think that that's there. Medicine law, I think, have slightly different issues. Medicine obviously touches on very, very intimate issues of human life and existence. And because of that, I think, has a category unto itself and needs to have a much more rigorous sense of professional behavior. And law, since it deals with the fundamental rights of citizenship, the right of a citizen is different than the rights of an employee. And because of that, because it exists, it deals with how you exist in the nation state, which, for good or for ill, is, you know, a fundamental unit of society that we have around us. We have nation states that are better at working than others, but nonetheless, we all got them. That law has a certain rights and responsibilities. Computing, computer software engineering, software development, to me, have the closest parallel with accounting. But accountants have that issue of risk that they bear as well, because if they misunderstand how the organization is accounting for its resources, how it's using for those resources, they're vulnerable, as we've seen in things like the Enron cases and some of the scandals that came out of 2008 on Wall Street. They need to have the protection of best practices and continued educational training, and software professionals need that as well.
David, we're down to our last two questions, and this one, I'm going to sort of mine all of your experiences in that. You are a global leader. You are this noted professor as well, and you've worked extensively. You've got a great history of success. So from all of your speaking, travels, and work, do you have any story to share, maybe something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
Oh, stories. I could bend your ear with stories for another couple of hours. Couple stories. One was a story where I was involved in the a computerization of a mining company in Peru. And it was done at a time of great economic and political unrest in Peru. And we were being shadowed by a terrorist group. We had a driver who was a young pup who liked to take risks that I didn't take. But what impressed me out of it was there were about five young men that I was working closely with. We were all about the same peers at the time. And their dedication to what they were doing and their utter belief that they were doing something to improve the lot of the people around them, to improve their family. And in particular, if you've spent any time in Latin America, you know Peru is a bit of an extreme example with a very thin ruling elite and a lot of very poor people. And that this was a group that was not quite in the ruling elite, but saw the value of knowledge and ideas and information to their organization and into the community around them. And it was a group of people that I taught some classes with them, I spent several days with them arguing about things. And in terms of just raw belief of, that they were doing good, that feeling, I will never forget that and forget their enthusiasm and the great joy they took in working together. So that would be one story. Another story is not my story, it's my father's. And it's actually a Christmas story. We're recording this thing during the Christmas holiday season. And it happened, 60 years ago when he was a young programmer. He was working in a Texas office of a company that was not doing well in Texas. They had overinvested and didn't have customers. And as the season rolled on, the group of men that he was with, and a couple women, recognized that they might be out of a job in the new year and were trying to figure out what to do. And with no customers and nothing, they turned their attention to this technology that deeply excited them. And that was the computing technology. And they took a UNIVAC 1103, which is a massive machine, and wrote a program that played Christmas carols. And they got the local newspaper to come visit them, and they had a party, I have a picture of it, with them all standing around this massive machine with a little white plastic Christmas tree singing along to the machine. And when I've told the story, I've had people jump on it and say, oh, that's the first iPad. And I'm going, that completely misses the point. People were interested in computing and music almost from the start. What was interesting about it was that their faith that their skills, that applying their skills would advance them, was so great that they engaged the machine in this when they had nothing to do. It was a way of increasing skills when there was nothing else to do. And pretty soon the office does indeed start to break up and people start shifting from what was they're trying to reach the oil industry. And they started taking database classes and doing other things to try and broaden their skills and move another one. And they all ended well. But that image of them standing around a computer, listening to play Silent Night, singing along with it, knowing that they were on the edge for their jobs, but that they would willingly spend 2 weeks to make this program work right because it taught them something. And it allowed them to shape their world, that computer room and that machine, in a way that interested them. Just, I mean, to me, speaks very deeply and very personally of the affection and the hope people have had in this technology. It's at one point a very abstract technology. Its first implementations involved solving partial differential equations, something that most of your listeners are not going to know and not really care about, but something that was identified as abstract and mathematically hard. And this is a moment that they shifted it into something that meant something to themselves and yet also thought that it was going to advance them. And that image to me has always just been very, very touching and sort of one of the key things to me that of these people singing along and looking to the future and thinking that this technology was going to be at the center of it. The last story involves just a very dear friend who I have, when I've written about him, I call him Doug the Rocket Scientist. Doug the Rocket Scientist actually was a rocket scientist, although he hated the term, and he would always correct me when I said it. I'm an aerospace engineer, he said. And he did satellite design. He worked on a couple of Mars rovers. He was at the Jet Propulsion Lab for a time, worked for various defense contractors, and got a restlessness in the middle years of his life that he loved the idea of exploring space. He loved the idea that has captured so many kids of rockets and astronauts and going to Mars, and that he built machines, part of teams that built machines that went to Mars. But there was something that was missing in what he did, and started turning to green energy, less polluting forms of energy, started learning California's various energy laws, and started to develop a company that would produce more energy-efficient ways of getting energy to the home and reusing the energy to the home. And he discovered that these were hard problems. There were not companies that you could just call up and say, I want a rooftop power unit. And so he started developing one of his own. Ended up passing the electrical PE exam to be able to do it. And one rainy December, now about 4 years ago, called all his friends and said, you know, come over to the house. We've got to put the solar panels on. He had, for various tax reasons, had to get the panels up and working before January 1st. And it took a great deal of effort. I would have gone, except I had a commitment, but I would gladly have flown across the country. And it was a way of both teaching his friends what he was doing. I followed the Twitter feeds, and I was just fascinated by what was going on, and watched him instruct these people of how to build an energy-efficient solar house, and do so in a way that was sustainable for him and his family, and spread the information and knowledge around. And that idea of doing it for the community, for educating the community, for building the community, always sort of, I found very touching and very moving as one of the, you know, central sort of beliefs that we have about this technology, that it does good for the community, and that it improves it. And if I can slide in just sort of a fourth story, which is related to this, about the same time I was given a phone call by a nice young man who said, would I like to be a keynote speaker at a conference? And I'm a professor, of course. I'd love to be a keynote speaker. And I went on for a little bit, and I stopped for a moment and said, excuse me, but what's this conference on, actually? And he said, oh, it's on crowdsourcing. And at that point, I'd never heard the term. And I said, I have no idea what this is. And there was this long, awkward pause on the other side. And the guy said, but you're supposed to be the expert. Well, we talked, and I realized one of my books indeed talked about what he meant. But I went to this conference, and again, the power and energy of the people who thought they were changing the world, who thought that somehow computing technology was going to make their lives better, their families better, and their communities better, was just really inspiring, and I loved it, and I've had a lot of contact with that group since and been very active with them. But it's that theme of the benefit that goes beyond yourself. You know, we live in a world of computer games where you can buy individual computer games and play them in the privacy of your home, and they're very popular and people do it. But the ones that have really engaged the world have been the social games, the ones that are global, where you're going on quests with others around you. And I think somehow the nature of computing and computing technology has always been involved in this idea of a global community. And the story that I'd like to end with, which is to me sort of summarizes it, was a dinner that I had with my grandmother. Probably the last dinner I had with her. It was in the 80s. I'd finished graduate school. I settled down as a professor. And we were gossiping about my cousins. And if you have cousins like my cousins, there's so much to gossip about. And they're all dear friends, and they're all close. And we were chatting away and talking about one of them. And my grandmother put down her fork and stared at me now with this odd look and said, you know, I've always been sorry I never used my calculus. I had a PhD in applied math at that point. I, you know, thought statistics and all of the advanced forms of math. And I let that go. And she was gone 4 or 5 months later. And this sentence just started bugging me. And I asked my mom about it. Mom said, she didn't go to college. I don't know what you're talking about. Talk with my brother. See if he can help. So I called my uncle. And I said, what do you know about grandmother and calculus? And he sort of gave us pause and said, well, she was confused at the end. She meant bookkeeping because she kept the books for our family gas station. Well, my grandmother was not a confused sort, but we did have a gas station. My uncle's family now runs it. In Ann Arbor, Michigan. In fact, if you have bought gas in Ann Arbor, we thank you. And hope you'll come again. And he suggested I talk to another family member who kept the family genealogy, and I talked with her, and it went on and on and on. And she finally said, you know, your great-grandmother cleaned hotel rooms. Your grandmother didn't go to college. And I just, still bugged by this, I decided to give it one last shot. I called up the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor and said, might you have my grandmother's transcript if she went there? And they said, let's look. And they came back and said, yeah, we've got it. And I said, really, did she graduate? And they said, yes, class of 21. And this is something none of us knew. And I said, what did she major in? And you hear this flipping of paper. And the woman says, oh, this is kind of interesting. She was a math major. And I eventually went there, and I went through all the old records. And in 1921, there were 12 math graduates at the University of Michigan, and 6 were women. And you look at the dates of these women, and they were all women who came of age during the suffrage movement. And they all believed that science scientific knowledge would help them, and math was the one field at the time that was open to women. In fact, most of them had thought they were going to be doctors and were a little bit miffed to discover that medicine wasn't open to them. So they took jobs doing computation for electrical utilities, for General Motors, for the Department of the Census, for actuarial firms, for health statistics places, because they saw in this a way of advancing themselves, of finding a place in society that women had not had. And my grandmother was, at some level, the least successful of the lot. She worked at our family gas station. The other five had long careers in doing calculation. And to me, these five women, in some ways, speak of the promise of what this field has. It's a field about knowledge and information, a field of spreading this information broadly, and using this information to help yourself, to help your family, to help your community, and at least a little teeny bit, helping your world. And I think if I were to give you stories, they would all circle around that theme, that this is something that people have believed in for 80, 90, 100 years, long before we had the machine, that knowledge and information would improve their lot, and that they could use it to improve themselves, their family, and their community.
Those are really remarkable stories, and thank you for sharing them. And we're down to our last question, and it's an open-ended question in that I turn the tables, and I'm asking you, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I would, at one level, ask, and this may go back to when you asked earlier, what were my favorite books on computing and computation, and what do I read, and how would I use them? And I would use this briefly as a moment to promote When Computers Were Human, which is where the grandmother story comes from, which is my favorite of the books that I've written. But also sort of point to the importance of reading the literature of computing, of trying to understand it. My father, when I was in junior high, took me through Don Knuth's three books on the art of computer programming. He now actually has a fourth volume, which is split in two. And doing that, working through those books to me with him, was just a very important time of my life and has given me a connection of myself to the literature that was very, very important and that I have relied on ever since. In fact, when I ultimately met Don Knuth, I stumbled around for about 5 minutes, falling over my tongue, trying to explain how important that time had been with my dad and with his books. And I don't think he ever quite grasped it, although we have become correspondents from time to time, and I'm very grateful for the connection. So, I mean, I think that's one of them, being sure to take the time out and look at some of the books and journals and other things that represent the longer-term picture of computer science, and that's important to me. The other is sort of in terms of dealing with this industry, how do you find it best to understand it? And, again, this is something I hinted at. Make sure that you ask people questions, in particular the generational change. We're a field that, you know, for roughly 30 years lived on Moore's Law, so that every 18 months we had a newer, faster, cooler computer. And we still have the spirit of Moore's Law, even though we've kind of moved beyond it. And so that we often forget the intergenerational stories and knowledge. And that I would encourage people who work in this field to ask questions, and ask questions about stories of how people got into the field, what they did, what they accomplished. Now, in doing this, you often get stories that sort of misplace people, and the tendency to put yourself at the center of a bigger activity is natural for all of us. But to ask them how you started your career, what was the first thing you did, how things worked, and how you got engaged, provides lots and lots of useful information and lots of lessons that we sometimes overlook. And so if I were to say, you know, what's one way that you can advance most quickly? Ask people questions and get them to tell you their stories. And I'm often asked sort of, where is this field going? What's happening? And that would be sort of the third one that I would do. And my response is I'm a very poor prognosticator in terms of getting into details. I would have, as one who had, you know, some of the very early smartphones, I would not have predicted its overwhelming change of the marketplace in about a 24-month period just 4 years ago. But I am very much a student of the long-term view, and watching computing technology as a means of coordinating human behavior and of changing the way organizations work I think I can have seen that arc very clearly in the past and can see that going ahead, in particular that the next 20 years are going to be largely dealing with two kinds of questions. One is, how do you build organizations and coordinate activity that straddle cultural boundaries, culture being the fundamental simple decisions we make in organizing our daily lives. And the second one is going to be dealing with that issue of employment versus citizenship. And employment may actually be strengthened, go one step further, and not just employment, but a coordination relationship. And what kind of rights and responsibilities do we have in the relationships that we develop in organizations across computing technologies? That's going to be the tough one to deal with, and 20 years from now, I think we will have more answers than we have today, but it's going to dominate what we work on during that period. So those would be my three things, and I've just enjoyed talking with you, as I always do, and sort of listening to what you find of interest.
David, you've taken us on this remarkable and insightful journey based on your considerable history in the industry, and as I mentioned in throughout the interview, through so many domains, and you're just a world figure leading in many, many areas. So I know your schedule is really demanding. You just got off a plane, in fact, before we did this interview this week, and then you're off again traveling around the world representing all the different communities and leadership roles, and moving the world forward in business and industry and governments and academia, media, and so on. So just amazing. So again, thank you for coming in today and to share your insights with the audience. Our audience will deeply appreciate all of the experiences that you've given us. And I just wanted to thank you.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity. I've enjoyed talking with you and hope things will continue in the future.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Alan Greer, 2013 President IEEE CS and a global top-ranking international technology authority.